Before we get into today's show, I have an urgent update to share with you. As you probably know, this podcast is made possible by the generous support of listeners like you. And with our financial year ending on June 30th, we're facing a $52,000 gap in funding that must be closed by that date. With just days to go, generous friends of the ministry have now offered to match every dollar given towards this goal up to $10,000. So please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim. It's good to be here.
And today we are talking about elections, politics, democracy, prompted, as you may have seen in the news, the fact that last week, as we record, the Prime Minister here in the UK, Rishi Sunak, announced we would be having a general election in just 6 weeks' time in July. Which for our international listeners might seem a bit surprising. We should probably briefly explain how our slightly eccentric elections work here in the UK. They aren't on a fixed schedule as such. There is a kind of there's a maximum amount of time a parliament can last, and at any time up to that maximum, the party in power, the government, has the ability to call the election when they want. So everyone was expecting Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, to wait until the autumn or kind of the end of the year, which was be when his clock kind of ran out. But he surprised everyone by coming out and saying, no, we're going to have an election on July the 4th. Bit of a shock for you too, Dad?
Yes, it was. Absolute shock. And as led to, the pundits have been going at great length.
Scrambling.
Just a question for you as the politics nerd, because in reflection, it's really weird, isn't it, that the Prime Minister should have this enormous political advantage of being able call an election at any time according to their own whim. And where does that go back to? Was that always like that? Unwritten constitution?
Yeah, it's part of the quirk of having our electoral democratic system has evolved over centuries. So originally, parliaments had no expiry date, and they were called by the king, the crown, the monarch. They would be elected, and then they would just stay until the crown decided to dissolve them and dispense with their services. Then there would be no parliament until he called an election and would have another one. And over time, as parliament, through a various long process, including civil war, accrued more power over the throne, that power to control, to call the election kind of shifted from the king to the prime minister. Even so, technically, to this day, the king calls the election, but he does so exclusively on the advice of, you know, when he's told to by the prime minister. But so the prime minister gained this enormous kind of prerogative power of calling elections. And then a few hundred years ago, in the kind of Victorian era, they decided having endless kind of alternal parliaments was a bit unfair and not very democratic. So they put a rule saying it had to be a maximum of 7 years initially. Then they cut that down to 5 years, was the kind of time limit. And after 5 years, no matter what, you needed to have another election to kind of refresh the mandate. But there was always a prerogative power of the king, then handed over to the prime minister to call the election. And there was a brief period about 10, 15 years ago when they tried to stop that, and they passed what was called the Fixed Term Parliaments Act. Ooh. So this was when there was coalition government between David Cameron, the Conservatives, and the Liberal Democrats, a centrist party. And obviously, the Liberal Democrats, part of the deal was, well, we don't want you to wait a few years, wait for your ratings to improve, and then kick us out and call an election. So they made a deal where they would change the rules so that parliaments ran for exactly 5 years, and you couldn't have an early election unless a kind of supermajority of MPs agreed. And that lasted for a while, but was got rid of a couple of years ago by the Conservative majority government. They decided they wanted to give the power back to the prime minister. So yeah, it gives the incumbents a huge advantage, because typically what happens, the incumbent you know, does 3-4 years of their 5-year term and then waits for the kind of opportune moment in that last 18 months to strike when their polls are as good as possible, when they're as popular as possible. And obviously it gives the opposition has to kind of scramble in response. Of course, the problem that Sunak has had is that he has for over 2 years now been catastrophically behind in the polls by about 20, 25 points. And he has been waiting and waiting and desperately trying to do things to turn that around. And it's only got worse. And so the speculation is he could have waited another 6 months to the end of the year when the clock would have run out and waited for something to turn up. But he potentially feared it might get even worse by then. So it's very unusual to go for an early election when you are, I think, 22 points behind in the polls and facing almost certain defeat. But yeah, he's kind of shocked the country by deciding, I've had enough waiting, let's get it over with. Maybe he just wants to bring forward the inevitable and retire and head off to California with his green card again.
And he's a very rich man, by all
accounts. Yes, he's a multi-millionaire business person.
But so it is a question, isn't it, about we suddenly find ourselves, everyone's just suddenly pitchforked into this general election. Interestingly, some very contentious debates that were going to happen in Parliament suddenly have got binned, including debates about abortion, decriminalisation and time limit, in which I'd been involved with some behind-the-scenes conversations with MPs. So it's suddenly a clean sheet. And now the question is, how are people going to vote? And particularly, how are Christians going to vote from your perspective?
Mm. Yeah, so I've been doing some, I mean, by total coincidence, over the last few weeks, not knowing the election was this close, thinking it was going to be in the autumn, everyone expected October, November, time, something like that. I've been doing some writing and research, looking at some studies, interviewing some kind of well-connected Christian politicos, which has actually turned out to be super practical and helpful to inform me for the next few weeks, looking at, how are Christians going to vote? So the kind of the wide presumption in the UK nationally is that the Conservatives will lose and will lose heavily, and that the opposition Labour Party, which is the kind of centre-left party, will take power for the first time in 14 years. And there's been a really interesting Evangelical Alliance survey of Christians asking them a whole bunch of questions, including how are you going to vote? And the kind of headline finding is that basically the Christians are kind of mirroring a lot of the shifts we've seen in society. And so they're, when you ask them how they're going to vote, the polling numbers are very, very similar within a few percentage points of the kind of national polls about for Labour, the Liberal Democrats, the Greens, the smaller parties, the Conservatives. The only real change is that Christians are slightly more likely to vote for the Conservatives than the wider population. I think in general population, the Conservatives are about like 23% and they're at 28% among Christians. And then there's a small kind of insurgent, more right-wing kind of protest party that's booming in popularity at the moment in the UK called Reform, which has kind of been birthed out of the Brexit movement and is part of the reason why the Conservatives are expected to do so badly is some of their vote is leaking away to this more right-wing party. And interestingly, the only other major change in the Christian sample is that they are less likely than the general public to vote for Reform. So more likely to vote for the centre-right party, less likely to vote for the more far-right party.
And it's true historically, isn't it, that in Britain, and certainly in England, that if anything, the tradition amongst evangelicals has been, and among the Church of England, has been more towards the left, drawn towards the sort of soft left, left-wing kind of politics than sort of very traditional conservative politics. I mean, there was famously back in the Thatcher era, Thatcher accused the Church of England of being a whole bunch of lefties who were not supporting her nationalist, patriotic agenda. And in a sense, that's carried on, hasn't it, ever since that time?
Well, interesting you should say that, Dad, because that is the perception, the myth, but it's not actually true. So what is fascinating is that the leadership, the public voices, the bishops of the Church of England have historically tended towards the left, or at least have been perceived to be more interested in kind of social justice concerns around poverty and inequality and things like that. And have often get a lot of flack from the Conservatives for kind of being woke, this language. But actually, when you survey people in the pews, particularly the Church of England has long and to this day maintains a bias towards the Conservative Party. And so there is this interesting division between the public voices and the leadership, the vicars and the bishops, who are often castigating kind of conservative policies around immigration or benefits or whatever. And actually the people in the pews in their churches are merrily trooping off and voting for conservative in large number. Whereas some other Christian traditions, so Roman Catholicism has historically been associated with Labour Party, often because Catholicism is predominated often among kind of more working class communities, Irish immigrants, that kind of thing. Though that is shifting and is no longer the case. It's kind of 50-50. And then the kind of low free church movement, so Methodists, Baptists, independent evangelicals, again, have historically veered towards the Labour Party. Again, a kind of anti-establishment, non-conformist vibe. But again, that is actually shifting more and is less true as those kind of historic partisanships are breaking down.
And the historical roots of all that are very interesting to me because it's one of the differences, isn't it, between the history of left-wing movements in Britain compared with left-wing movements on the continent of Europe. So left-wing movements on the continent of Europe were heavily influenced by communism, Marx, and...
Ultimately, the French Revolution, in many ways.
The French Revolution was the source of it all. So it was a kind of... a very sort of strong atheistic, anti-religious movement on the continent. Whereas, interestingly, in Britain, there was this very strong link between of Christian socialism, wasn't there? Of particularly dissenting Christians who allied themselves with the left-wing movement. And the English Labour Party was strongly influenced, wasn't it, by Christian socialism, and therefore has had this very different flavour. Left-wing politics in the UK has had a very different flavour from left-wing politics across continental Europe. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, often the kind of cliche is that the modern Labour Party owes more to Methodism than it does to Marxism, is the kind of famous adage. And I think it can be exaggerated, but it's certainly true that there was a coming out of the 19th century when a lot of these radical working class socialist movements began to gain power as the vote was extended to kind of more and more people outside of the traditional elite. Certainly there was a long tradition, you know, going back to things like, you know, prominent Quaker industrialists who had been advocating for better working conditions in factories and for workers, but were obviously not interested in overturning the system and burning down, you know, the whole system because they were the wealthy businessmen themselves. So that, you know, there was a long Christian tradition of kind of what you might say is kind of moderate, incremental liberal reform, didn't have the kind of radical revolutionary edge that a lot of the kind of left-wing movements on the continent. And that has certainly remained a strong strand in modern Labour Party thinking. It waxes and wanes in different eras, but certainly, yeah, there are to this day there are a large number of Christian MPs in the Labour Party who would argue very strongly that their faith kind of influences them to land in politics that way, more kind of incremental reformist, you know, trying to find better accommodations with capitalism maybe rather than to kind of burn it down and start from scratch.
And so you've been looking at an interesting report about the relationship between church attendance and religion and political, the likelihood to vote.
Yeah, what's really interesting is while British Christians are largely aligned in their kind of party preferences with the broader population, what they do stand out is their kind of enthusiasm for democracy and elections in general. You know, so UK general election turnout in recent years has been between kind of 60% and 70%, but when the Evangelical Alliance surveyed Christians, they found 94% said they were either certain or very likely to vote in the next general election. And when you look at other kind of measures, so when they asked, you know, are you a member of a political party or actively campaigning for one, 10% said they were, whereas only 1.5% of the general population said they were. And evangelicals are also more likely to contact their local MP, to boycott a product for political reasons, to donate money to a campaign, lots of other measures. They're much, much more engaged than the average citizen is. And then there's a separate report by the think tank Theos looked at bigger data pool. and found that even people who are kind of nominal Christians, you know, who will tick the Christian box when you ask what religion they are, but don't go to church, wouldn't kind of meet many standards of what it means to be a believer. Even they are slightly more likely to vote than the average or like the atheist Briton. And the more likely you go to church, the more times a month you go to church, that kind of propensity to engage and to vote just goes up and up and up.
So that's counterintuitive in some ways, isn't it? That why should it be that the more committed people are as Christians, the more they believe in democracy, effectively? Mm. I mean, this sounds quite... Is this a particularly British phenomenon? I doubt whether you'd find that in the States, would you? Or in some other countries. So is there a particular British connection between Christian belief and a genuine positive sense that democracy is important and that I have to participate as a citizen in the democratic debate, even though it's a secular government, it's secular politics and so on?
Well, the thing is, it is and it isn't, right? Because still our politics and our church, even those who aren't Anglicans, is shaped by the fact that there is an established state religion in this country, right? The Church of England. And the king, whose government we are electing, theoretically, is also the supreme governor, the head of the Church of England. And so in some way, the MPs and vicars kind of work for the same guy. Now, that's obviously a gross simplification, but you know, there is this weird kind of quasi-institutional role for the church that has been born out of establishment. And even though today, you know, less than probably 1 or 2% of the population actually attend an Anglican church, it remains the legal, established, constitutional church in this country. And I think that has bled over into Christianity more general, so that it's very, very common for churches, not just Anglican ones, but for other church denominations, to be used as, for example, polling stations on election day. And also they often will host hustings, you know, these local debates where the candidates in a seat will come together and the vicar will often be the moderator of a debate and they'll take questions from the electorate. And these aren't churchgoers. These are just random members. But the church building is seen as a kind of neutral civic space, which isn't partisan and political, isn't associated with a particular side, but is clearly engaged, highly engaged, involved in the process. So I do wonder, there's got to be something, some kind of connection to the establishment of the Church of England, I think. But also the sense that the churches in this country, despite having their, as we discussed, mild biases towards one or the other, they've never become totally co-opted by a political movement. You know, it's, you can't say, oh, Baptist churches, oh, they're Labour churches. It's never that simple, right? So I think they maintain a sense of like, we are kind of impartial, fair people to hold the centre ground, in which when we have this highly divisive election debates, we need a kind of impartial person just to hold the ring for us to have these arguments.
Yes, I was just reflecting the fact that it's very common in not just in Church of England churches, but in many church services to have prayers, intercession for the government, for the prime minister, for the monarchy, for politicians and MPs and so on. This is again seen as, even though we don't agree with them, we pray for them. Yeah. And we see them as instituted by God, I suppose, if one was to take the wording of Romans 13, you know, yeah, that even such a corrupt emperor, the Roman emperor, was still, according to Paul, instituted by God to govern. And so that tradition that Christians support the state and then... What about democracy, though? Because democracy is a recent invention, historically. Why should Christians be so much in favour of democracy as opposed to, why, you know, get control? Let's enforce Christian, you know, let's have a revolution and enforce Christian views on everybody.
Yeah. So I think that's a much more interesting question. And I very rarely hear a kind of theological case made for democracy, which, as you say, is a kind of relatively recent human invention. It's not, you know, laid out in the Bible. It's and yet I think very often it's taken for granted in British churches that God is in favor of this, maybe thinks this is the only legitimate form of how a state could be organized and governed, which I think is a contentious argument, you know, and I think we probably do need to have a bit more robust thinking through why is democracy superior from in Christian terms to other forms of government? As you say, particularly as this is, you know, in the States, you're seeing very open conversations on some parts of the Christian right about is there better ways, you know, rather than retreating and being, you know, outvoted by an atheist society, is there a better way, as you say, of trying to defend Christian principles and values rather than just hoping to be a majority in the ballot box? So I think we probably do need a more thoughtful rationale about why is it Christians' responsibility to vote. And to be fair, there are minority Christian traditions which would have a more skeptical view of the state and have and say a little bit more about, you know, we're exiles in Babylon. We don't need to get enmeshed in Babylon's internal affairs in the same way. You know, the Anabaptist tradition, for example, has a much more kind of skeptical view of whether Christians can pursue the common good through kind of secular state structures.
That's absolutely right. Yes. But to, you know, pursue the Babylon metaphor, we're seeking the good of the city. That is a, you know, that in exile, yet we still seek the good of the city and act as citizens. So there is that strain in biblical teaching and biblical theology. There's been right back to the Old Testament. But it is interesting how democracy has been adopted, I think, by the vast majority of Christian thinkers. And of course, there is a brand of political theology that does defend democracy. And I've heard that defended basically a lot of it on the basis of that Christians take seriously the fallenness of human nature and the risk, therefore, of totalitarian, authoritarian control. And that for all its flaws, democracy takes seriously human failings. And in particular, what it's often said is the greatest triumph of democracy is not so much the fact that, you know, a mass of the electorate are always going to make good decisions. The greatest triumph of democracy is that after a fixed amount of time, we can vote to get rid of the current lot. We may have not.
Which we are about to do in the UK, most likely.
In other words, it's not that we have enormous, unrealistic belief that the next lot are going to be vastly better, but at least we've got the power, we, the electorate, to get rid of the current lot. And that, you know, within a Christian perspective, chimes with our both, you know, our understanding of the fall, that politicians are fallen and can only frequently become corrupt, but also that we have the dignity of choice, that we are made in God's image as individual humans, and therefore we have the dignity of choosing, and we have freedom to choose.
I think that's absolutely right. What fascinates me about this conversation is how what we take for granted, you know, the cornerstone of democracy today would be, you know, universal suffrage, the fact that every person over the age of 18 gets one vote, the same as everyone else. But that, as we know, is really, really historically recent, you know, 100 years. In fact, we haven't even hit 100 years since all women got the vote in the UK. You know, we're still about 4 or 5 years away from the centenary of that. So, but when you look at, for example, the founding of the United States and the framers of the Constitution there, the founding fathers, many of them very clearly motivated by Christian faith, and did very strongly believe in these ideals of liberty and, you know, restraining tyrants. That was why they'd fought against King George in the first place, right? To free themselves from the tyranny and to be able to govern their own affairs. They would have been absolutely horrified at the idea of universal suffrage. In fact, many of them openly wrote against it and said, of course not. We don't want to be ruled by a king over the sea. We want to elect our government. But the only people who get the vote are those who are mature enough, educated enough, rich enough, own enough land, men, slave owners. So they had a radically different idea of what it meant to implement those kind of values of freedom, restraint of corruption, liberty, and very strongly would have argued that absolutely not does Christian require something as foundational as we would see as universal suffrage.
Yeah, and it is interesting, isn't it? Because you know, there's this ideal of democracy. So this ideal, what political theorists talk about, you know, is that democracy provides a space for deliberation, for discussion, argument, decision making, resolving conflict, and therefore, in order for that to happen, every citizen needs to be well informed. They need to know the truth. They need to be educated. But in addition, every citizen has to have a kind of moral formation. Every citizen understands the meaning of the good and has values which are appropriate as well-meaning and so on. And then you look at reality of democracy and you say, yeah, well, really, good luck with that. How in reality it seems that so many people make voting decisions, you know, ill-informed, based on prejudices, manipulated by the media or by their favorite pundit. And it's a long way from that wonderful ideal.
And that explains in part why so many people, so many thoughtful, intelligent people over so many centuries strongly resisted the idea of kind of full democracy, because they said you can't trust everyone with the vote. You know, what about, how could you give power to someone who's never been educated, who doesn't understand the issues at stake, who they will be seduced by tyrants and despots and demagogues. And, you know, as much as I disagree with the principle, I don't think you should restrict the franchise to people who have kind of earned it. Like, they're not entirely wrong. Like, a lot of people are seduced by demagogues and populists. And we've seen, particularly in our current era, a lot of governments have come to power off the back of untruths they've told during election campaigns, by smearing minorities and whipping up, playing to humanity's baser instincts. And so I think there is an interesting question to be said about the theory of democracy is all very well, but does it break down in practice when the electorate is not this kind of educated, sober body of virtuous citizenry that the theory would hold?
Yeah, and of course, this is part of the reason why there is a sort of a move across the world to say, you know, democracy is not the way forward. It works to an extent within a particular area of the world, within Western Europe and the USA, North America, but actually in many, many parts of the world, it's a disaster. And maybe we'd much better to go for some other form of government, you know, by technocracy. We have technocratic governments or oligarchs or benign dictatorships, because at least we get firm government, at least we get technocratic skill and excellence, as opposed to the complete chaos that democracy generates.
Yeah, and China is the kind of shining paragon of trying to pioneer an alternative way, and people, a lot of the developing world looks at China and says, look, they have gone in a couple of generations from abject grinding peasant poverty to, you know, world leading tech superpower, and they've never had a meaningful election in their lives. Whereas what, if we did what the West would say, we would, as you say, get mired in endless rounds of squabbling, and there would be corruption, people try to buy votes, and we wouldn't actually build anything, we wouldn't actually develop anything. Why don't we follow the Chinese model? I can see the allure of it in many ways, particularly at a time when Western established mature democracies are throwing up a lot of chaos, making a lot of bad decisions, electing a lot of bad governments, not giving democracy the best possible counter argument to this. I mean, personally speaking, I still think the long historical view demonstrates that democratic governments vastly outperform authoritarian ones over the long term in terms of prosperity of their citizens, peace, development. But yeah, we are certainly in a moment where the Chinese model, use that language, seems more alluring if you are, let's say, a sub-Saharan African state or a struggling Asian kind of fragile post-democracy coming out of an era of civil war than the kind of fractious multi-party Western democracy.
I've also heard the argument, which I think has some weight, that if you look across the world and you say, where does democracy at least work partly, it's almost exclusively in places that have a Judeo-Christian heritage, that democracy can work if there are Judeo-Christian assumptions. And and that to the extent that those Judeo-Christian assumptions, and interestingly, that is supported by the fact that it's Christians who are most in favour. Why are Christians most in favour? Answer, because it does match with our Judeo-Christian understanding of the state and so on. Hmm. And that as those Judeo-Christian assumptions diminish and undissolve and are corroded away, democracy itself becomes harder and harder to sustain. If you look across the world, the outlier is India, because India often prides itself on the world's greatest democracy, numerically speaking, and it doesn't have a strong Judeo-Christian foundation. And if anything, now the ruling BJP party has a very strongly Hindu nationalist foundation. So then the question is, can democracy survive historically in India? And I think there are many pundits who would say actually probably no. It's certainly under threat. So there are fascinating sort of links, aren't there, between fundamental philosophical underpinnings and whether or not democracy can actually work.
Mm. I mean, there are a handful of other counterexamples. People point to the plant somewhere like Japan, which post-World War II has had a very well-established democracy handed over peacefully power. I mean, not that often. It has one kind of very dominant party, but they have lost occasionally. Power is exchanged, and again, no Judeo-Christian heritage to note. Obviously, that system was, contribution was imposed top-down by the occupying Americans after World War II, but seems to have been relatively well integrated. But yes, I take your point in general. And I think one thing we didn't mention, actually, the Theos survey here in the UK didn't just look at Christians, looked at all religious groups. And the fascinating thing, the most interesting finding was that, if you recall, the more likely Christians were to go to church, the more likely they were to vote and engage in politics. But the exact opposite was true of other religious groups. So the largest religious minority in the UK are Muslims. And if you look at kind of like nominal Muslims, they had very broadly similar answers to the wider society in terms of likelihood to vote and that kind of thing. But when you looked at measures of kind of religious practice and adherence, so the, you know, more likely you are to go to the mosque, or the more likely you are to follow various religious rituals in Islam, fasting and prayer and stuff, the less likely you are to engage in the political process and the less likely you are to vote. So quite opposite, the more kind of faithful Muslims, the more observant practicing Muslims, the more disengaged they are from Britain's broadly secular, though potentially we're arguing founded on Judeo-Christian values, democratic process.
That is really interesting, isn't it? And of course, Islam does have a very different understanding of politics, the relationship between politics and theology. It doesn't have that fundamental separation, which many people trace back to Jesus himself, who said, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar, and to God the things that are God. And that, although that precisely what he meant by those words has been endlessly debated since, it's pretty clear that he is, he's not aligning what God is doing and what Caesar is doing. There's always been in Christianity a separation between understanding what the state does, what Caesar's domain, and what God is doing, and what people must follow. I don't think in Islam that distinction appears. And ultimately, it is a kind of theocratic understanding of the state, which is what Islam tends to put forward.
And you can see that in history, you know, even from the very early days, even after Christianity kind of took over the Roman Empire, there was always an emperor and a pope, or in the Eastern Empire, an emperor and a patriarch. They were never the same person. And there was endless tussles about who held more power, temporal, spiritual power. Could the patriarch or the pope, did they crown the emperor, or did the emperor choose the pope and vice versa? And this has been an ongoing source of quite productive tension for centuries. Whereas in the early Islamic state that grew out of the conquest, there was a caliph, a single individual, and they were simultaneously the leading temporal spirit power, the political power, and the head of the leader of the faithful. And so they have a completely different kind of tradition, as you say. And then the Reformation teased that out even more.
I'm just reminded of in the House of Lords, I think they still talk about the Lords temporal and spiritual, don't they?
They do, yes.
Some of the Lords there because they are the temporal lords, and some of the lords in the House of the Lords are the lords spiritual, which are the bishops.
Yeah. Which is another insane example of our constitution in which 26 of the leading bishops of the Church of England get automatic seats in this upper chamber of parliament, but let's not go there right now. But yes, I think even more so than post-Reformation in Europe in particular, you had, you know, centuries of religious warfare, which only really ended when governments accepted that they weren't going to try and impose religious uniformity on their people. And you might have a Protestant king who had to accept, I've got some subjects who are Catholics, I'm not going to try and kill them or make them Protestants, and vice versa. And so we have a tradition of religious liberty and a distinction between the religion of the state, if there is one, and the religion of the people are allowed to diverge. And I think political Islam has had a very different gestation and evolution. And so it doesn't super surprise me that the more pious, the more observant Muslim you are in Britain, the maybe more disengaged you are from the democratic process. But we shouldn't, you know, take that too far. There are obviously vast, large numbers of practicing Muslims who are MPs, and, you know, we've got Mayor of London, formerly the First Minister of Scotland, were practicing Muslims. There's a Hindu Prime Minister right now, very observant, practicing Hindu Prime Minister. So it is a genuinely kind of diverse, multi-faith democracy we live in, but different faiths certainly have different political theologies, that's for sure.
Yeah, and just as an aside, I think a recent study suggested that across many countries across the world, it was Britain that was most successful in immigrants being assimilated within British society and doing well within British society.
I just wanted to quickly remind you that this podcast is made possible by the generosity of friends like you. And right now we're facing a $52,000 funding gap that must be closed before the end of our financial year on June 30th. Generous friends of the ministry have offered to match every dollar given up to $10,000. And so I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now. Your gift will help to keep important conversations like this one coming to listeners like you. Closing this gap in full by June 30th is vital, so please give your best gift today, knowing that your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Anyway, I'd quite like to pivot in the final bit of this podcast to talk about what else but artificial intelligence.
Oh, you shocked me.
I know. I just came across this fascinating paper called AI, an Epistemic Risk for Democracy, a Coming Crisis of Public Knowledge. And we'll link to it in the show notes. But it's a very interesting assessment and question of how the widespread use of AI is going to impact democracy, and not just in the sort of explicit disinformation. We've talked before, haven't we, about the fake Joe Biden telephoning
robocalls, yeah,
voters and all that. This has a more interesting and sophisticated analysis, and its basic argument is that when democracy is functioning well, it can be seen as a form of information processing. There's a kind of collective cognitive action going on. There's deliberation, discussion, argument, persuasion. And in order for that to happen, citizens need to be well informed about the truth and also to have been morally formed and educated to understand the value of deliberation, discussion, and all that kind of stuff. And the real worry is that as AI penetrates throughout the information sphere and in education, it actually starts to distort these essential features of democracy. So it both distorts the information that citizens have access to, but it also distorts the whole educational process, the whole way in which morality and moral values are created.
Could you explain a bit more about that? How exactly is AI going to kind of interfere with our moral formation, for example?
So one of the things that people are not well aware of, I think many people aren't, and that is that these generative AI models, which are now spewing forth vast amounts of material, are actually based on amazingly complex equations, probabilistic data analysis, and so on, by which they select words and so on. But actually, what then comes is there's a very, very strong element of human filtering and even manipulation of the output. So all these models go through a process where human beings are paid in order to monitor what these models produce, and then it's called reinforcement learning, much like the way you train a dog. No, you don't do that. No, you don't do a poo in the corner. Now, this is what we like. Yes, we reward you if you do that. They do exactly the same with these models. No, we don't like using those rude words. No, we do like it when you
good
say,
good, ChatGPT. Good boy, exactly. ChatGPT. No, exactly. Don't tell people how to make a bomb when they ask for it. Bad, ChatGPT. Bad, ChatGPT.
Exactly right. Exactly right. That's exactly what goes on. And they train them repeatedly, 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 repeatedly. And of course, what they then do is they introduce all kinds of hidden biases. Because, of course, it's human beings imposing their own values on what the text that these things are generating. And there's the fascinating little thing where it turns out that there are certain words which most of these models use far more than in general usage in the population. There are certain keywords that just come up time and time again. And one of them is commendable. So AI says that's very commendable and so on. And it's been worked out. The reason for this is that many of the people who actually do the work of training these models are based in countries where then like India, where they're peace workers. And so it's Indian English, which is being rewarded. More than
which often has a slightly kind of old-timey,
exactly,
you know,
slightly
yeah, they're
archaic.
Still kind of learning it from 1950s textbooks and all that kind of thing, and so it's a slightly archaic cadence and vocabulary, yeah,
exactly. And that explains why often these things sound slightly quaint.
That is so interesting. I didn't
and,
know that.
And use sort of long, complicated explanations because that's they're being trained. But that's a sort of trivial example. It just shows you that what comes across as apparently persuasive, neutral, objective is actually heavily biased by the beliefs of human beings. And so then what happens, of course, is that they influence human beings' preferences because they're influenced by this wash of AI stuff that's coming to them. That is then picked up by the AI and becomes new data for the AI. So the AI feeds on itself. There's, to put it technically, it's a recursive loop between the human beings and the AI. We get locked in this echo chamber and we don't have access to the authentic beliefs of other people or the authentic truth, the unbiased truth.
And I think the other angle or the other aspect in which AI might start to interfere with our politics, our elections, our democratic process is around news and journalism, which, as we know, we discussed on the podcast, is kind of struggling financially at the moment, and there are increasing kind of what's called kind of news deserts where the local news radio station or the newspaper has had to shut down, and there's this literally an area which there is no one covering it. And what is the slightly alarming part of this paper, that this report that you read, was where they were kind of theorizing or imagining what would happen if AI technologies were used to try and fill these news deserts, you know, where you might have an AI news outlet that was quote unquote covering a kind of US state capital, or in UK context, you know, a local council, which doesn't have any local journalists there. Would that work? Would it help to inform the people, or could it unintentionally start steering votes in a different direction depending on the biases of the people who trained it and how it was kind of interpreting the news that was coming out of that area? And given, you know, in particular, we know and understand that AI is riddled with hallucinations where it kind of invents facts but that sound like they could be right but aren't actually true. I have to say I am deeply, deeply concerned about the prospect
This is touching a nerve, Tim, I sense here, because of course you were our man in Tunbridge Wells, weren't you? You were the journalist.
At the start of my career, for my sins, I spent 10 months being a local reporter, cutting my teeth as a local journalist in a small commuter town in southeast England called Tunbridge Wells, which is a very sleepy, quiet place. So I spent a lot of time attending council meetings, arguments about planning permission for new housing developments, parking disputes.
Your greatest coup was something to do with a pig.
I did save the life of an escaped pig. That is true. We probably shouldn't bore the listeners too much on that one. Send me an email if you want to hear that in a subsequent podcast, the full story about the pig, Poppy the pig, she was called. But anyway, that's a good example. That newspaper still exists, but it no longer has any journalists based in Tunbridge Wells. You know, when I was there only 10 years ago, 11 years ago, there was a team of five or six of us covering that part of Kent and East Sussex. And the paper still was published, as far as I'm aware, but it's based 30, 40, 50 miles away. I think it's largely a group of even more underpaid and under-resourced journalists than I was there, who were kind of trying to churn out stuff scraped off the internet. So there's a real calamitous decline in the quality of local journalism. And how can you do an election, a local election, let alone a general election, if you don't know what the candidates are stand for and what they've achieved in office?
And so do you see this? I mean, the argument in the paper is that possibly this could have at least, you know, the AI-controlled outlet that just routinely reports, you know, what happened in the local government and what the local candidates say, and then does automated polling of local, the population and so on. It's better than nothing. It's not ideal. You know, ideally we have a human in the loop, but is this better than nothing?
It's an interesting question. You know, what it calls the minimum viable product for news, you know, meeting the minimum standard for the information need of a community. I mean, if the choice is literally between nothing and this, maybe there's a conversation to be had. But I do worry that it would create as many problems as it solved. Because as we've discussed, you know, the AI has a kind of illusion of neutrality and impartiality, but it actually is riddled with errors, biases. It holds up a mirror to those who programmed it fundamentally. And obviously human beings also have their biases and their errors, but for good or for ill, I think the institution of a local newspaper on the whole worked well to represent the views and the concerns of its local populace. And I just worry that rolling out something like this at scale, because it had to be at scale, right? So you would have some kind of, you know, national Washington DC or London based organization that would be implementing its local AI news outlets in a faraway community. They don't fully understand the people there. They don't understand the needs, and local news lives or dies on its rich, deep understanding of the people it is serving. And so even aside from my concerns around, you know, hallucination and bias, I just think actually the product would be very, very poor value. And it wouldn't interest people. They would continue going to Twitter and Facebook groups and all the other kind of social media dreck that they're currently filling their news feeds with, rather than this kind of probably quite bland and often erratically inaccurate AI outlet.
Yeah. And another, just before we draw things to a close, another interesting suggestion analysis was using AI for polling, for assessing people's attitudes, but also for predicting them. So this is already happening. A lot of businesses are now using AI to predict what the punters would actually think. So instead of having a focus group where you call people together and you discuss your new product and you ask them to feedback and so on, which is very expensive and depends very much on how you got your focus group, why not have an AI which will, you know, take all it knows of who our target audience is and then analyze the product and come up with an opinion. And so this kind of sometimes called synthetic polling is being used. And part of the problem they point out, apart from all the obvious problems about bias and so on, is that by definition, AIs are backward looking. They're trained on previously obtained data. And therefore they can't reflect the reality of what's actually happening at the moment. And there's a very interesting example they quote, and that was apparently at the outbreak of the Ukraine conflict several years ago now, when Russia invaded Ukraine, an AI was asked to predict how people across the US would respond to this and whether they would be in favor of sending armaments. And the AI predicted that the more right-wing people were in the populace, the more likely they would support sending arms to Ukraine. The more left-wing they were, the less they would be supportive of sending arms to Ukraine. And of course, as we know, in reality, it was exactly the opposite, that it was the left-wing party, the Democrats, who were more in favor of sending money to support Ukraine compared with the right-wing party. Mm-hmm. And I think this is just an example of how an AI which is trained on past preferences and data may get it catastrophically wrong when it predicts the future.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating example. And it underlines the fact that it is very, very difficult to predict human beings. You know, my fundamental kind of skepticism about AI, or the kind of boosterish claims about AI, is that it hasn't even begun to approach the complexity of actual human beings. And you can feed, you know, terabytes of data into these models, and they still can't get close. They're a kind of Crayola picture version. They're a kind of terrible pastiche of the actual complexity of real human beings who are, you know, over the kind of population of millions, is just incredibly difficult to predict. And so I am hyper skeptical that we are going to be able to kind of short circuit the whole polling situation with synthetic data through AI. I think that is going to be an absolute dead end, I would confidently predict. More concerningly, it would give an opportunity for kind of bad faith actors to be massively manipulative because you can then generate your own data, your own sample, nudge it a certain way, whip up interest in the it's so obvious. I mean, we already had a version of this with the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal around Brexit and Trump, and you know, the allegations that you could use kind of targeted advertising and surveys on Facebook to push people in a certain way and manipulate how they were going to vote in certain elections. You know, it's all very contested, but people have been trying this for a long time. Yeah, I just think it would be the height of naivety to believe that we can kind of unleash these AI models into political polling and the political machine and not have bad faith actors try and use it as another weapon to kind of interfere with the genuine democratic process. I mean, the story it makes me think of just briefly is a very interesting sci-fi story by the writer Isaac Asimov, who wrote a short story, this is decades ago, probably in the 60s, about how in the future computers would get better and better at extrapolating in elections from how a slice of the electorate voted. You know, you could show them how 10,000 people voted, and they would use that and they would crunch the numbers and say the result of the election is going to be X. And then over time, as they got more powerful, the sample size required got smaller and smaller until the moment of the short story, they only need a single voter to go into one polling booth to vote. And from that single piece of data, the computer can tell and will anoint the winner of the election. And it's obviously a slightly satirical story, but it elaborates the kind of ethical, philosophical concerns of when the human involvement is whittled away and the computer gets more and more involved and something as important as deciding who wins an election how much power are we ceding to the computer, or in reality, the people who programmed the computer? Okay, should we draw our conscience to close there? We've hit 52 minutes or so. Yeah, please do write in and tell us what you think. How are you feeling? Because obviously there's elections elsewhere in the world. There's an Indian election in India. There's an election coming up in the States, presidential election in the States in November, and I'm sure many other countries as well. So wherever you are based, however politics is looking in your part of the world, do get in touch. We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email us by...
Yeah, I'm just thinking it's like there's a bright light being shone on democracy this year, isn't it? Many people are pointing out that 2024 is the year when, democratic elections, a significant proportion of the world's population are being involved in democratic elections. And I think exactly the issues we've been talking about today are, there's a very bright light being shone on democracy and whether or not it's fit for purpose in the 21st century, and what is the role that technology is going to play.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all up for grabs, isn't it? And it'll be very interesting to see how the church acts in this kind of crucible as democracy is kind of coming under strain and being tested in ways maybe it hasn't been in the West or in kind of established democratic countries for some time. So yeah, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this important question. You can email us molad@premier.org.uk. We'll include some links in the show notes, some of the studies we've been mentioning if you want to read that further. But thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode, but until then, bye-bye.
Of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.